So just gradually, slowly bring your attention back outwards. Just taking your time. Okay. In a way, that's often how lodge workings begin. And I can't say for certain that's exactly what the unfortunate did, as she died in 1946. But it is what my teachers taught me. I was taught by two men, one called W. Ernest Butler, another man, his pupil, Tom Olliman. Ernest was taught very directly by Dion Fortune and was a fairly, very senior member of her fraternity. And in a way, what we're talking about when we look at people like Dion Fortune and we look at these very ancient but quite hidden traditions, what we have just done is pretty much exactly what they will have done. We're talking about what is really an underground tradition of spirituality. That happens as in small rooms, that happens in private places. Maybe thousands of years ago it was different, but for generations really, since the Middle Ages, these things have been studied in rooms like this. You know, I work a lot in Jerusalem, and there's a place in Jerusalem, a little place in Jerusalem called the Bethel Synagogue, which was the premier, probably Kabbalistic training academy in Israel for hundreds of years. And the room is still there, and it's a tiny little room like this. Because the real work, the reality of people like Dion Fortune, Ernest Butler, Bill Gray, people like that, is in a certain way invisible. If we look at the unfortunate life, she lives till she's 56. She was born in 1890. And if we think about all the changes in the world since 1890, if I even think myself about the changes since 1955 when I was born, and the esoteric world I encountered in the early 70s, we're talking about a completely different world. We're talking about a world where it was very hard to find out about these things. You know, if we walk down the high street, we can probably find the esoteric practices and traditions of pretty much most of the planet. Even back in the 70s, and certainly for someone like myself living in Clydach in Swansea, in South Wales, these things were very hard, very, very hard to come across. But they were available, and they were available really because of the work of people of generations before, people like Dion Fortune and Ernest Butler. Now, Dion Fortune was originally born in Sheffield. Apparently, a family related to a firm who used to make knives and forks, Sheffield Steel, and the great steel industries were there in Sheffield, although her branch of the family wasn't really doing that. When she's 12, she moves down to Somerset, to near Weston-super-Mare, where her parents run a spa complex. And her parents, or at least her mother later on, becomes a Christian Scientist. And so there's a sort of an interest in alternative healing in the family. But and a sort of predisposition in that direction, but no real links with esoteric traditions or any sense. So, whatever she gets, she doesn't learn it at her parents' knees. There's a sort of legendary story, who knows if it's true or not, where her mother is supposed to have said that while she was a baby, the baby suddenly died on her lap and came back to life again. And she felt that the soul that had come back again was not the same one who'd been there. We're never going to know if that's true or not. It's like with people like Dame Fortune, legends accumulate with surprising sort of ease, really. But certainly what seems to have been there at the beginning is an incredible will and an intention to kind of try and find her own way. Which, around the turn of the 20th century, was relatively unusual. What she does initially in her life is she starts off by, she goes to, there's wonderful titles they used to have in the sort of early 20th century, Studley's Horticultural College for Young Women, which was a sort of to produce lady gardeners, effectively. And which also catered for lady gardeners who were young lady gardeners who were troubled in some way. And there's another story of Dame Fortune, a tested story, this of her greeting one of the newer pupils by saying, "Are you mad or crossed in love?" Because that's how most of us end up here. And it gives a sort of insight into a profoundly patriarchal world, pre-World War I, where we're looking at the high point of the British Empire. We're looking at a time when England really did rule much of the world and was absolutely certain in its values. And, you know, it's extraordinary when you think of some of the things that she did in her life, in particular, I think more than anything maybe, the return of her work around the return of the goddess and the feminine principle. God knows that was a world that needed it, but extraordinary to be bringing it back at that time. You know, she would have been 24 when the First World War broke out. And she had strange encounters, really. The woman who ran the Studley's Horticultural College for Young Lady Gardeners was herself an unusual and quite powerful woman who was very independent, very strong-willed, and had some ability in hypnotism, and there's a very famous encounter that the young Dame Fortune has with her, because they fall out over an issue of ethics. The head of this college is apparently, according to Dame Fortune, we don't know, we shouldn't defame people, but it's her story we're following, was apparently using her hypnotic powers to enable persuade some of the elderly, so they had some elderly guests to contribute to the financial running of the institution. Dame Fortune took exception to this and thought it was ethically unsound, and they had an enormous fight, and she, as a result of which, she decides she's going to leave the institution. And there is a famous kind of account you find it in her book Psychic Self-Defense, where she talks about the warden of Studley Hall spending all of one day simply repeating, "You will leave because you are hopeless and incompetent. You will leave this place because you are hopeless and incompetent. You will leave this place because you are hopeless and incompetent." And the unfortunate was young, impressionable, probably very psychic, and the effect of being told over and over and over and over and over and over again by someone of tremendous will and authority, caused her effectively to break down. She ends up admitting, I am hopelessly incompetent. I will leave because I am hopelessly incompetent. In fact, she ends up saying, I will stay because I am so hopelessly incompetent I can't go anywhere else. Now, this is actually a traumatic and powerful thing for her, really. And one of the things that it did, I think, was to give her a real understanding of the importance of understanding psychology. And there's many threads of her work, and in these eight talks, we're going to be trying to pick up some of the threads. Eight talks is too short to pick up all the threads. She's a very multifaceted woman. But one of the threads is the combination of esoteric inner work with psychological work. And in her own recovery, in a way, from Studley Hall, she signs on to a wonderful place called the Medico-Psychological Clinic at Brunswick Square. It was one of the very early training places for psychotherapists in the UK. And she becomes with something called a lay analyst. Lay because not a doctor. And again, it gives us a bit of a glimpse into that older world, really, where healing was very powerfully under the control of registered medical practitioners. I had a sort of interesting small insight into that myself once when I was doing some work with the Royal College of Psychiatry. And they live in a wonderful square in London. And the people who work on the reception, if you're a man, they have to call you doctor, because any man, by definition, is a doctor. And I would say to these, I worked for quite a long time, I'd go, they say, no, I'm not a doctor, I'm just Ian. Okay, Dr. Ian. Ian. It gives us a glimpse into a world, again, where an environment that is, doctors are simply powerful, but then they were phenomenally powerful. So she was breaking very, very new ground again in training as a lay analyst. She didn't do it for very long. I suspect she didn't like it. A couple of years, and she went off to the land army. She appears to, while doing her time in the land army, to be famously difficult, because they end up. She ends up running a research institution on her own. She has a number of jobs and they keep moving on because she can't get on with people. But what happens in the end is she talks about it a little as actually really quite enjoying. She was looking after some samples of growing wheat, and something to do with soya bean as well, really, can't quite remember. But anyway, she spends much of the rest of the war really just looking after the growing soya beans and the wheat samples, but having quite a lot of time on her own. And in a way, that takes up until 1926. You could say she's interested in fringe ideas. She's dabbled in psychotherapy, she's interested in soya beans, but she has not yet any direct experience of anything that you'd call esoteric work. She does, however, get interested in theosophy, which is one of the big, really big spiritual movements at the early 20th century. And one of the things that happens to her is that she has a vision, or one night, a dream that turns into a vision, really, where she experiences herself walking through the Theosophical Society library and finding at the end of this library a door that isn't there. And then, in stepping through this door, finds herself somewhere very high, maybe in the Himalayas. She thought it was the Himalayas. And there are two great figures, one whom she calls the most wise and the other whom she calls the most holy. And these are great beings. This is a great opening for her somewhere where she is experiencing beings that are enormous spiritual beings, I suppose. And she very much, and she senses these beings are examining her soul. They're concentrating upon her, trying to decide something. And she's very attracted to the qualities of the most wise, who she says feels very kind of very powerful, very centered, very like steel, very focused. But slightly to her horror, but she's quite accepting of the situation, she is given actually into the care of the most holy, who for her represents the quality of love. Because it's the quality she most that the most holy says, this is the quality you most need, this is the quality that you most need to work upon. And there's a sort of interesting, right at the end, jump right to the end of her life. A book called Aspects of Occultism, which is some of her essays. There's a essay called The Death of Vivien Le Fay Morgan. Now, Vivien Le Fay Morgan is a character in two books, novels that she goes on to write. One, Sea Priestess, the other, Moon Magic. And in a sense, Vivien Le Fay Morgan is really her magical personality. It's really her deepest sense of herself. Just as, in a way, when we were doing the exercise of wearing the indigo robes and contemplating these qualities of wisdom and power and love and connection with nature, the Vivien Le Fay Morgan really is this sort of archetypal sense of herself as priestess. And right at the beginning, as I say, right at the beginning of her esoteric life, there's this thing, is she going to go with love, or is she going to go with wisdom? And in this Death of Vivien Le Fay Morgan, which was mediumistically received by Margaret Lumley Brown just after Dean Fortune's death, it's talking about the death of Vivien Le Fay Morgan, but in a certain sense it's also talking about the deadly death of the unfortunate. And in this little story, her teacher, a woman called Lena, Vivien's teacher, a woman called Lena, comes to her at the moment of her death and says to her, "When I began to train you," she answered, "I knew there was that in you that would get carried away by its own power. You cannot do without power, but it must be allied with love or with wisdom." "With wisdom, certainly," I said. "We did not use love in Atlantis, in the sense that modern sentiment allots to it." "My dear, you have all the terror of sentimentality that the power type often has. You forget that the power itself can be a form of sentimentality, and some of the most cruel men and women in history were the most sentimental." It's just an odd little reminder somewhere that one of the issues that she was likely working on in her life was this quality of love. In some ways, from the accounts of her life and the things that I've heard about her, this is a very powerful woman, this is a very wise, clear woman, but this is a woman who actually has difficulty in relationships. She gets married, but the marriage doesn't last. She has intimates, but the relationships break down. So she's not a perfect woman. But she is a very interesting and powerful woman. And what happens to her, really, after the vision is, as often does happen when you have a very, very powerful inward experience, you have apparent coincidences happen, where you meet people and things start moving in outer levels. And one of the people that she meets two people, really. One, a woman called Maya Curtis Webb, who is the Lena figure in the story I've just told you. And Maya Curtis Webb initiates her into something called the Alpha and Omega Lodge of the Golden Dawn. Now, end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, there's a great upsurge in matters esoteric. A lot of it linked with Freemasonry, Co-Masonry, Theosophy, I've already said, but this is a particular strain that arises that looks at the Rosicrucian tradition, looks at alchemy, looks at the Kabbalah, and the most famous organization of the 19th century around that is something called the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, set up by a bunch of Freemasons, but including men and women in its order. The infamous Aleister Crowley is one of the great illumini. It was begun by a man called MacGregor Mathers and his wife Moina Mathers. And it's into this organization that Dionne Fortune is initiated. But she simultaneously makes a connection with a man with a wonderful name of Theodore Moriarty, which is just a great name, Teddy Moriarty, who is a South African Freemason and occultist, and who is a bit of a one-off, really. He is the figure behind Dr. Taverner. If anybody writes a selection of stories called The Secrets of Dr. Taverner, who is this sort of adept, who is a healer, kind of sort of fighting darkness figure. And it's based really on the figure of Theodore Moriarty. And Moriarty really is Moriarty and Maya Curtis Webb are really her main physical teachers. More Moriarty probably than Maya Curtis Webb, because what happens? She doesn't stay very long in the Golden Dawn. She publishes a book called The Esoteric Philosophy of Love and Marriage, which was regarded as by a fellow esotericist in the Golden Dawn as a betrayal of her vows and secrets. And as mildly scandalous, it's again a reflection, really, on the times. I think it's actually it's one of her least interesting works, probably. But it was enough to get her chucked out of the Golden Dawn. So the person that she remains with is Theodore Moriarty. Now, he is a sort of unorthodox Freemason, sort of Kabbalist, sort of Theosophist, kind of occultist. He has created his own sort of system. And if any of you know Dionne Fortune's book, The Cosmic Doctrine, he was in some ways quite influential in the development of her teachings around the Cosmic Doctrine. But what he enables her to do is to create it. He enables her to begin finding a framework for her inner experiences. And after he dies, she's about 30 then. She's immensely self-confident. And she offers to teach all the rest of his pupils. And most of them tell this precocious young woman to go to hell, because they don't want to be taught by any young whippersnapper, thank you very much. But a small group of people come with them. And at this point, Mayor Curtis Webb, later Trenchill Hayes, pops up again. And she starts then to do the work that really is the work that she is, in different ways, is occupied for the rest of her life. And that work is to be a point of contact between the inner levels and the outer levels. Because what she starts to do is to start to go into trance, And she starts to communicate with beings that she calls the masters, or teach, or inner teachers, or sometimes inner contacts. And for all the rest of her life, what she is about helping people to do the same thing. So she spends the rest of her life creating frameworks, creating methods, working with people directly, so that they are able to make a connection between ordinary outward experience and what she comes to call the inner planes or inner levels. Now, in order to do that, she has to really look at, well, how do we do this? How can we possibly do this? At the same time that she's trying to do this, one of the dominant forces in esotericism in Britain is theosophy, which is saying the way you do this is by you study Eastern tradition. You study yoga, you practice the methods of esoteric Buddhism. And her very strong, very powerful kind of feeling is that nothing, she had nothing against those methods, but that actually what she is there to do is to create a direct connection between people living in the West and their own mystery traditions, that through generations of persecution and oppression have become lost. So what she is doing, in a sense, is finding the almost extinguished flame and in the old mystery traditions of the West, and finding ways to bring them to life again. And finding ways to bring them to life again that are appropriate for the psychology and personalities of people living at that point in the 20th century. And, you know, it's an almost extraordinary thing to decide to do, isn't it? I mean, actually, she didn't decide to do it. In fact, it comes from a deeply intuitive, deeply place that arises out of her inner experience. She finds herself connecting to something that supports her and that encourages her and that moves her in a particular direction. Now, when we began with the meditation, the method of meditation, you will have noticed, involves the description of images. The description, it involves coming into relationship with the body, slowing down, but then engaging with images, whether visually or kinesthetically or orally, through whatever senses. But it involves the experience of the embodied image. And that image, if related to, and if related to the body, creates a bridge between the everyday normal consciousness knocking on the table and profound inner experiences. It's effectively the creation of a ladder between the outer and inner worlds, which as we become more and more skilled at, enables us to make connections and enable a flow of consciousness and energy between these different levels. Now, if you remember what happened, or at least what happened to me when we began the meditation, is that you start to notice that as you come into yourself, as you start to slow down, and as you invite the presence of inner energies, there's a movement between time and timelessness, space and stillness. And if we can then engage with the images that arise, what starts to happen is they come alive. We become aware of a secret life, a moving life that is more than the life of the mind, that is more than the life of our normal conceptions, and that has its own impetus. And that is pretty much literally what she did. She would sit down with three or four people. We So she'd have a lot more people, but she would do pretty much exactly as we have done. Would come, would sit down, would literally, and then she would literally be robed because they were really working in a more ceremonial way than we just have. And they would be building a connection between the everyday selves, everyday experience, and this sense of something other, which for them was represented by the idea of the of these masters of wisdom. Now, it's odd that there were no mistresses of wisdom at that point. It's not odd. Partly what people are doing at that point are they're working with their own psychology, they're working with the energy of their times. So and one of the big sort of ideas around that time, promulgated by the Theosophical Society principally, was the idea of these masters of wisdom who are secretly running the world. And it's interesting, it's an imperial idea. I personally do not believe that masters of wisdom are secretly running the world. Or if they are, they need to go back to masters of wisdom school. Okay. The things are not going so well, currently. But I don't think that's how it is. I don't think that's true at all. But in the Zeitgeist that you're talking about, a patriarchal, imperial world where it was natural to think in a pyramid hierarchical way, with masters at the top, kind of relating to everything. And so, one of their ideas, the ideas of that time, is as you reach into the inner world, you will find these powerful beings who will help you. And certainly she did find powerful, interesting beings, really, that she starts to relate to. And who are, in effect, the driving energy behind the Fraternity of the Inner Light, which then later, and these days, is now called the Society of the Inner Light. But what she had to do was to sit in rooms, allow herself to come into relationship with the inner and allow the arising experience to speak through her. And one of the first beings to speak through her, who doesn't seem to exist, as far as we can know, but claims to exist and still says he exists, is a man called David Pasteur, who introduced himself as a subaltern killed on the Somme, who is a sort of junior master who is acting as an aide-de-camp. So he's a blood military imagery. Aide-de-camp to the senior masters who are trying to create this new fraternity. Like I say, he gives biographical detail about himself and says he's from a family in the Midlands, family ran a cyclist shop. And subsequently, people have checked out or tried to check out these details, and he doesn't exist. So what are we to make of this? Because one of the obvious conclusions to draw at this point is that she's making it up, or she's deluding herself. But I have to say, if David Carstairs is an illusion, he is a remarkably consistent illusion, and I would have to confess to being equally deluded by him. Because in my own inner work, I feel I have come across David Carstairs, who turns up in my inner experience as a subaltern from the First World War, and who uses the imagery of the First World War to convey profound mystical truths. I think of another example, and one of the other figures who turned up there, somebody she calls the Chancellor, who is an obscure liberal chancellor called Lord Erskine. Who did exist. but who, as far as one knows, in his earthly life didn't have any esoteric interests at all. Third person who turns up is Socrates. So, the plot thickens and maybe gets madder and madder as you sit here listening to me. So now we're talking about, okay, the profound inner experiences coming from a first world or simpleton who doesn't exist, an unsuccessful chancellor in England who was only there for a few months, and Socrates. Does sound a bit mad, really. And in a way, if we take it literally, it is a bit mad. What I experience when I experience the Chancellor, the soldier, what's the other one? The philosopher Socrates. What I experience are presences that use the form. If I believe in them, they believe in me. So there is a level of reality that is experienced by suspending disbelief and participating in the experience. If I sit there saying to David Carstairs, you don't exist, when, in my experience, my literal experience right now, actually, he's standing somewhere there. He's not really standing there, but in my experience, he's standing there, looking rather quizzical and kind of skeptical, as he often does. If I say he doesn't exist, I deny something of my own experience. If I say he exists, I deny something of my own experience. If I participate in the experience of David Carstairs standing a little to my right, then something interesting starts to happen. Sadly, we've become very unsophisticated in our understanding of the imagination and subtle senses. And I teach an awful lot about the imagination, and I'm sick to death of the is it true or not? So please don't ask me, is it true or not? Right? That it's not a helpful question. It doesn't work. The question is, what are the fruits of the experience? It's the comment of Christ, you shall know them by their fruits. Now, the fruits of the unfortunate sitting in a room and talking with these beings, and not just talking with these beings, allowing these beings to come into her sense of her body, to speak through her, is that she creates a body of work that enables people to wake themselves up, that enables people to become conscious of their deeper intelligence beneath their kind of cognitive and surface personalities. It enables people to come into a wider sense of the world, a sense of connection with the world of nature, a connection with each other. It enables a sense of the return of the goddess. At a time when people weren't thinking about it. You know, at the time that she's operating, we're not very far at all from the suffragette movement and women not having the vote. We're really at a time when men used to say the most terrible things about women. And everybody, including men and women together, would nod at it. So a woman who, in the early part of the 20th century, talking about the feminine divine principle and the necessity of the return of the feminine divine principle is an extraordinary thing. And it comes through her. It doesn't come because Violet is the unfortunate, is a self-generated genius. She's not. She's a remarkable, bright, powerful woman. But what she does is she sits in a room, she sits down, she comes into her senses, she attunes to these beings who appear to her. And instead of, are you real or not, prove to me you're real, she engages in relationship with them. As I say, the first figure that appears is this subaltern, David Carstairs, who comes through and who quite naturally is talking about the war, but is also talking about a sort of mystical version of Christianity. And really talking about the beginning stages of how you create a mystery school. So he's talking about how you meditate. He's talking about some of the basics of the meditation method we began with today. He's talking about how to do this. It's not just that he's talking about it, they're doing it together. Because in order for her to communicate with him, the whole group, she has to surrender into his presence, and he manifests through her in such a way that people can experience the sense of something other. And so what she does is to set up simple ritual conditions that are pretty much identically to the method that we began with, whereby she and her colleagues would sit together, they would invoke the archangels, they would connect to the depth and the height and come into the sense of the center. And then they would invite the masters to come and be with them. And there would be a sort of a communion, a meeting of worlds, a meeting of hearts, whereby not just knowledge, but experience, energy, consciousness-changing experiences would happen. Now these are then built into the training structure of the Tree of Life, which she goes on to later develop. These things are also built into her novels, which she writes, which are also connected with the Tree of Life. So she creates a structure to within which she and other people can experience the sense of this other world and these beings who live in the other world who want to help us bring the two worlds together. And she teaches really a path of inner transformation, where what starts to happen is that as you become aware of the body, you start to become aware of the mind and the feelings. You start to become aware also of the capacity of the mind to create images and to allow those images to bring together the mind and the body and the feeling nature. That becomes a reflecting dish within which deeper awareness can be experienced. So what happens as we sat together, as we put on the indigo robe, and as we reflect upon these qualities of the qualities of what she calls the three rays, of the ray of nature, which is the ray of power, the hermetic ray of wisdom, and the devotional ray of love. These qualities come into us, and if we can let ourselves become that figure, we then start to become connected to that deeper, wider world. And as we do that, what happens is we acquire a depth of presence, a sense of centeredness in the heart that then opens us to deeper and deeper experiences within ourselves. The mind starts to open up into a quality of wisdom and clarity. The emotions open up into a quality of lovingness and compassion. And what starts to happen, we become more and more skilled at being with the sense of the mysterious and stepping into that place. Into the place of unknowing, that wonderful Christian mystic work, the cloud of unknowing. It's like we step into that cloud, and in that cloud we are met. We are not alone, we are not abandoned. These figures, whether they are the figures of the Chancellor, who is this kind of figure of kind of power and clarity, or David Carstairs, who is this mystical kind of warrior, or the very wise figure of Socrates. These are, if we can allow ourselves to be met by figures like these. Now, the figures that meet us in the cloud of unknowing in the play may not be the same figures, or they may be slightly different. It doesn't matter. What does matter, though, is that you suspend disbelief and engage in the colloquy between that which appears to you. And one of the great problems at that point, normally, for people is the sense of doubt that arises. Is this real? Is this true? Am I deluding myself? That you can work out later. That you only find out. You only find out if you're deluding yourself by the fruits of whether you're deluding yourself. If you're deluding yourself, actually what happens is you'll inflate your ego and nothing much will happen around you. If you're not deluding yourself, there will be the experience of new life, new energy and growth that will become tangible around you. And part of you won't like it. That's the other thing that's a good test of that. But to try and determine whether inner experience is true or not in the moment is always self-destructive. It just takes you out of the experience and back into your mind. One of the problems we have is we have a constant commentary going on, constantly judging, constantly comparing, constantly discussing our experience. And the necessity, and what she did, was to step out of the commentary of experience into experience. It's to stop commenting on your world and be in your world, and to trust the inner energies that arise in you. Now, that's not easy to do, and it's why she did need to create a fraternity, and it's why she created, and it's why she wrote things like the mystical Kabbalah, and she wrote structures and processes, so this thing can be studied step by step. But the heart of what she does is just simply what we began with today. Slowing down, coming into the body, stilling ourselves, coming into a different sense of ourselves, trusting the images and the energy that arise when we do this. And then you see what happens. You see who comes to meet you, and then you talk with them. And if you continue the conversation long enough, remarkable things happen. Maybe you set up fraternities or sororities. Maybe you write incredible books. And she did both of those things. But it came step by step. Not as a great revelation, not as an inspiration. It came by simply sitting down each evening, patiently paying attention, listening, recording, and then working it out in some way or other. So I just want to conclude this evening by just another brief meditation. Which will just link, just continue this theme. We have another time for questions, but this is not just bring this light down again. So once again, what I would like you to do, if you will, is to just close your eyes and to come into relationship with your body. I've been talking quite a long time, so your minds will likely be stirred up in different ways. But just for a moment, just letting the mind be stirred, but just noticing the body. Noticing breath, noticing body, coming into your senses. Just letting yourself step into the inner worlds, just simply by paying attention inwardly. And notice the tug of the outer world by the sounds outside. But just relaxing in and down. And as you do that, just be aware that you are still wearing the indigo robe. So all the time I've been talking and listening, the indigo robe was still there. And as you do that, you become aware of the presence of the four great archangels, of the sacred earth beneath us, of the moon, sun, and stars above us. And in the center, there is the fire of Azrael, the blue sea fire. Fire that rises from the sea, the impossible fire that opens the gates. So right in the center of your being, find the sea fire. It's blue, green, watery fire. And if it is right for you, let yourself step into it, feeling this strange watery fire rising up around you, touching all the cells of your body. Awakening, refreshing, bringing life to all parts of your being. And it is as if you are moving through time and space, carried by the fire. Maybe that you find yourself walking along the embankment of a great river through a mist. And ahead of you is the shape of a woman in a cloak. A wide-brimmed hat. And somehow you know that this is the figure of Dion Fortune, in whose footsteps you are literally following. And as you do that, it is as if your footsteps come into rhythm with hers, walking together along the banks of the great river, walking in her footsteps, following her way. And at a certain point, she crosses a bridge. And you choose, if you will, to cross with her. And you find yourself standing before an old converted chapel. The strange eight-sided tower. An old oak door, which she holds open for you. And invites you into the house of Dion Fortune. And if you will, you step in through the door. And you find yourself in a room, a living room full of images and pictures. of the unfortunate, of David Costes, of the philosopher, of the chancellor. Find images of the tree of life, images of the great mother. Find all the detail of her life and work. Images that you can step through, images that you can take into yourself, images that will feed and inspire. Know that you are welcome in the house of the unfortunate. Know that you can return here whenever you will. If it is right for you, receive her blessing and her invitation to return. And after a while you see that she is holding in her hand the sea-green flame of the fire of Azrael. And once again you look into the flame. And once again you step into the flame. And you allow it to carry you back to this time and this space. Feeling the flame nourishing your cells. Feeling its watery fire bringing life to all your parts. When you're ready, letting yourself step back out, letting your senses come into the room. As you do so, looking once more upon the fire of Azrael held in my hands, letting that lock the experience, letting it ground the experience. Now we step back into the outer world, but knowing that the inner world is just a breath away. If you wish to, you are still wearing the indigo robe. If you wish to, the archangels come at your call. If you wish to, you can enter the fire of Azrael and walk in the footsteps of the unfortunate. Uriel, Gabriel, Mikael, Raphael, go in peace. Take a moment to just get orientated again from wherever you've been. And we have a little bit of time for questions, not a huge amount of time, but let's just see if there are any questions. I'll do my best to answer them.
question about David Carson.
Yeah.
Whether he's sort of an entity that's sort of been born on the other side in the inner world, some total of all the life experiences that he's had, and gives us a name.
I have no idea. I mean, he's this actually very powerful. He appears as just as this very wise, but very. He's almost like an archetype. He's not just an archetype. He's almost archetypal, but he relates as a human, just like you're talking to a human being. He's famously, he's a bit notorious for saying, well, he's been refusing to answer questions like that, in a sense, because he just says, well, I'm me, and actually what you have to do is not explain me, but talk to me. And in a way, I think what you have to do with these things. He said, because it's, you find out by relating to, you find out who he is to you by relating to him, I think. And he just won't answer questions like that, so I don't know. It's literally the house that she used to work in London. It's called the Bell. What's the name of the Musselman's restaurant? So it's now a very posh restaurant, which apparently you can, if you're lucky, arrange to go and have a look at. Her book Moon Magic is pretty much set in that building, really, And her reading of the Eight Sides was that it represented the seven planets and an empty place for Earth. So that's how she looked at it.
What would you say would be a recommended starting place for a newbie in a reading wise? You know, like first book to read?
Grounding and Autumn, yeah. Her great work is The Mystical Kabbalah. It's hard, however. That book backed up by Ernest Butler's book, Apprentice to Magic, those are the two books I started on years ago. The other thing that's great to read with her is her novels. Her novels are full of the most extraordinary kind of images, and in particular, The Sea Priestess and Moon Magic. But any of her novels are great. I think if you want to really get seriously into it, you do have to try and tackle the Kabbalah and her book, The Mystical Kabbalah. But it's not a practical book, that. It's very, very theoretical. That's why Ernest Butler's book, the Apprentice to Magic. There's another one called The Magician, His Training and Work. And then a third one called Magic and the Kabbalah. Yeah, those were the ones I started on. And because in a way the Ernest books give you a way of practice that helps you turn the theory of the mystical Kabbalah into something that you can experience.
So it's Ernest Butler, The Apprentice to Magic and the Kabbalah, and another one? Magician, His Training
and Work. Makes it sound like a job, doesn't it?
Thank you.
And as I say, read the novels as well. Novels are actually quite inspiring.
I think one of the things that I've become aware of, over time in Rastenberg, is, you mentioned about her references to the divine feminine in her time.
Yeah.
And how much we so take for granted. It's very hard to put ourselves into the environment that Dion's actually living in.
Totally.
And there's so much up and down in Glastonbury. I can go to a ceremony, and right there I see all Dion's words. And I just think how much he has influenced what is actually going on here in Glastonbury.
Enormously influential in lots of places, because the two novels, Sea Priestess and Moon Magic in particular, really brought a sense of the divine feminine to people who had no idea even what that could be. You know, she opened lots of, and it is genuinely astonishing. And she's dead in 1946. You know, that's the really extraordinary thing when you consider that environment. I mean, I remember even in the 70s how hard it was to get hold of Rothko's books. I mean, it was like buying porn in those days. You'd send off to these obscure addresses and you'd come back in brown, you know, plain brown paper envelopes and kind of, it's all very exciting actually in some ways, but even in the 70s it was very, very difficult.
I had to be scared to death when I got my first book. That's only because of the fact that, you know, this was not the world that I lived in.
No, totally not. Absolutely, you know? Not.
Yeah. It was a cult, whereas here, you know, it's out there on the street and such. The mysteries are still there. I think that's what Dionne did a lot of work, was helping us to discover the mysteries. And, you know, we see people in Glastonbury just living those mysteries.
I know. We've got a lovely memory from my own in the 70s of going off to visit my teacher off at Swansea Railway Station. My father, chasing me down the street, shouting, "Why are you going to visit old lunatics here?" And raging with it didn't go well, my religious interests in my parents' house, I have to say.
New things always happen. It always jumps people up. When she would be in temper. But also around that time, there's these huge archaeology things happening first of all. And I think, I'm right in saying, people like Jane Harrison, who were like to be incredibly conservative.
Yes.
Who was placed in her home, although she had a career. But also, we're investigating the idea of ancient, perhaps matriarchal
women. Yes, that's right.
And it was all around in the ether.
It was, and Jane Harrison was a big influence on Dionne Fortune. There were two great rituals that she worked with, one called the Rite of Isis, the other called the Rite of Pan. And both of those rituals drew from some of Jane Harrison's work, really. Because she was drawing on whatever she could find at her time that could speak to the need to revive these ancient mysteries, and so it is. And there wasn't a lot around. I mean, Jane Harrison was one of them actually. It was very, but we never heard two books. Like, what's one? Themis. What's the other one called? Remember? Can't remember. Anyway, this archaeologist Jane Harrison produced these two extraordinary books. Which really looked at the matriarchal basis of mystery religions, and they were very influential on the unfortunate.
One of the interesting things as well, in a time when a lot of our internal spirituality seems to be very self-referencing all the time, the great occultists always were hugely aware of these external influences, and you have to draw on those. That's what makes you great, isn't it? The fact that you're drawing on so many different
and at the service of something greater than yourself. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about and at the service of a tradition as well. I think that's one of the things that you know, there's a sort of, in some ways, the cult of originality in our time is, there's nothing wrong with originality, but there's a what she was interested in was the connecting with a stream of awareness and understanding that had become lost and needed to be found again. And no individual person can just find that again. You have to connect to it and, in a certain sense, be at its service. And in a way, she is almost like a version of the Delphic Pythoness. You know, she places herself at this. Most of the time, when you read about her life, she's at the service of these inner experiences, but opening herself to them, letting them come through her, and letting them embody in her life and in the life of the people around her. That included her writing books, creating structures, articles. So, her creative output was enormous, but she wouldn't have understood it as original in the sense of my creative work. She would see it as the work that was coming through her, and that's the major distinction, I think, an important distinction. She didn't own it, in that sense.
I also got the impression that whereas the ancient oracles were mysterious, obscure, point of nobody understanding what they were talking about, the unfortunate great work was to make things open, understandable, and public.
I think that was that's another astonishing thing that you did, really, because again at the time, all the esoteric interests were about in secret little groups, and you don't tell anybody, and you have this vow of secrecy. I mean, she does this amazing thing during the war where she creates these war letters where she writes to anybody, actually describing these secret methods in ways they've never been described before. So really, in a way, getting ideas out there, using the Xerox machine, which was her technology of her time, to get things out. And she is probably one of the first people to do that. It's a really remarkable thing. And in a way, again, it's part of that not wanting to own things. You know, her need is to help others connect to this extraordinary thing that she's found for herself.
Yeah, I was quite interested in that Lean Ray you're talking about. I don't know if you could expand on that anymore.
Yeah, sure. I mean, basically, one of the structures that she used was that in her training of people, it was that she felt there were three major energies or rays that she felt that people needed to work with. The green ray she saw was the ray of nature and connected to the principle of power. Then there was the blue ray of wisdom, sometimes called the orange ray, but deeper levels of blue. Which was about kind of clarity in the mind, and then you have this third ray of devotion in the heart, and that was where kind of esoteric Christian teachings come from. The green ray, in particular, there's a wonderful thing which in one of the later talks we're going to look at, called the Chant of the Elements. And it's a funny little sing-song rhyme, but it's incredibly powerful, because in the green ray, she's really about working with the elemental energy of the earth, working with earth and water and fire and air, and looking and feeling our need to connect with the green life of the earth. And again, this is extraordinary. It's at a time when, you know, there's no such thing as ecological understanding in her time. We're talking in the high water mark of industrialism, and we'd even industrialized war at that point. You know, so she is saying something actually that later on we've come to understand is crucial to us. Partly now because we're destroying it. These are one of the three pillars of our house, in a sense. The green ray, the grey ray of nature, the wisdom ray, and the ray of the devotion of the heart. And what she felt was that we are temperamentally inclined to one or another. She would say that we need to have aspects of all three rays in ourselves. But that generally speaking, we tend to associate with one more than the other. My own teacher, for example, Ernest, and also Tom, were inclined to the ray of devotion and devotion to the mystical Christ. Colonel Seymour, another member of her fraternity, was in a way the priest of the green ray, and so he was mainly to do with nature contacts and the sort of earth energies. And so it was the structure that she used really to help people kind of identify their tendencies and the places they needed to balance in themselves. Because she would say if you are too specialized in one ray, you need to balance it up with the other. It's why that meditation we began with contains elements of all three rays. So we're in the indigo row, we have to have all of the three qualities in us. But our temperament will mean that we will lean in one direction more than another. But we're trying to have all three there. So.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit
I'm really interested in these dangerous words you've been using, and words like give yourself over, surrender. And so,
yeah.
I mean, there are sort of occult practices that you're talking about, I think, of. Ways of doing chants that perhaps are not practiced anymore.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say something about your training, maybe sort of spiritual hygiene and being clear whilst being a...
Well, if you notice what we did, I mean, this is really why we did what we did today. So we began with a meditation that gets us present, that gets us into a connecting to energies of wisdom, power and love. And then we invite these energies, these archetypal energies called the archangels, which create a sealed and protected space. And it is within that space that she would the arising of energy from the inner that then can be surrendered to, without those preliminary practices. It's a bit like sort of saying, well, here I am, universe, anybody, come and walk in, use my body, take me, do with me what you will. Mm-hmm. Could have a little fun with that sometimes, but it could lead you to a lot of trouble. And in a way, that was why the trance work she did was always preceded by this process of sealing the space and aligning to deeper intentionality. That way, then it was safe to do it. It's one of the reasons why she wrote a whole book called Psychic Self-Defense, which was really about, well, how do you look after yourself in these ways? Because actually, as you do open to the inner, you not only does the inner become more visible to you, you are visible to whatever else is in the inner. And like any other set of relationships and experiences, you just need to look after yourself.
I think it's also worth mentioning as well, when you are going in onto some really deep levels, you know, like within a lodge or something, or within a group, it's not just about that preparation beforehand.
No.
There is the preparation that you do before.
Before you come. No, that's right.
As soon as you start to think, oh, today's the day.
Day, that's right.
You know, you start that preparation for. That's when you're starting to go into really deep levels. It doesn't have to be that heavy.
No, but of course you're right about it, and of course you're part of a discipline anyway, because actually it wasn't just a question of turning up at lodge meetings. People will have been meditating daily. They will be, you know, so all of that is part of the process of keeping yourself safe and keeping yourself aligned. And you know, it's in a way it's that daily practice that means the lodge meetings do become deep places, because people meet together with an aligned intention and trained imaginations and wills. And that's when things do then get into very deep levels.
When you brought in the archangel,
yes.
It was one feeling of safety.
Yes, exactly.
Especially from behind, I then felt it.
Yeah.
They're very often exposed,
especially. Yeah.
In, yeah. Very powerful.
No, I love the archangels. They're probably one of the first things I learned to work with. And they're the one thing that, you know, they've accompanied me all my life, really. And it does create this great sense of protection from behind in particular.
Permission to ask for them.
Oh no, absolutely, no, definitely. You should, just as I've done, use your own words. But so you very simply, you know, you can do that whole meditation agenda very simply yourself. I mean, just sit in a chair and ask them to come out, to come and surround you, and sort of, and you get interesting images sometimes when you do that. Sometimes the images are traditional, sometimes they're very non-traditional. And again, what happens is you start to build a relationship with the archangel, and the space gets deeper as you do that, as you practice it. The nice thing about the archangels is you can do it in about 5 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you can just ask them to come and give you a hand. They're very generous.
Okay, that's everybody. I think that might be a place to stop.
Yeah,
here.
Good point to stop. Yeah.
So I'd just like to say thank you. Because it's not just about educating ourselves about Dion's work. It's experiencing it, isn't it?
I think so.
And it's a lot to do with recognising how much of it we may actually be doing within our own lives.
Indeed.
Already.
Exactly.
You know?
And
I think what you've done for us is given us that experiential component to it as well. It's given us the background. Because I know what the talks are coming out, I can see, oh, that's where it's going to fall that out, and that's where it's going to fall that out, and focus on that. So I'm quite looking forward to that.
Good.
So our next talk is not until the 3rd of November?
That's right, yeah.
Fifth.
Gunpowder, treason, and plot. Excellent.
I just need to turn this light out.
Yes, I know. It's horrible, yes, you go standing up.
So, I mean, if anybody else wants to carry on with learning a bit more about Dionne, it's actually another talk, which is why we've been saying about, you know, she's having a real laugh at the moment. Because there is another talk here in this room next Tuesday. And that's the Wessex Research Group, which are giving it. And Gordon Strong, who is an author and also very knowledgeable about Dionne's work and such. And his title is Dionne Fortune, Priestess and